Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 372.1P0407, certificate number 26973. The Doomsday Clock.
Dun 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 dun.
It is menacing.
Dun.
It does seem like maybe the scariest clock.
It has Doomsday right in the title, but yeah, think about that. Are there scarier clocks? What if a villain turns over like a like a little sand
an hourglass, Wicked Witch of the West,
and you have that long to escape your bonds, or
it could be the little clock that's on a few sticks of dynamite in a movie.
Right.
I feel like that doesn't happen anymore. Nobody needs to buy a clock. Right.
I saw one just the other
when
day.
When the Bond movies went digital, that was the end of analog clocks on dynamite.
I'm trying to remember whether it was a new movie or an old, but it did seem kind
of... Or real life.
It could have been real life. I could have been diffusing a bomb.
Was it in the trunk of your car?
I was watching a thing and it felt like, wait a minute, are we really like trying to decide whether to clip the blue wire or the red wire here? Oh, you know what it was? My daughter's mother/partner got me to watch a television show from the 90s.
L.A. Law.
Or 2000s, probably. It was about a young woman who becomes a CIA agent, but turns out she's actually a member of a bad group masquerading as the CIA.
Is this Alias with Jennifer Garner?
There it is, Alias with Jennifer Garner. She was like, oh, we should watch Alias.
It's not good, but she's going to wear a lot of wigs.
I said, I don't want to. And she said, no, it was really good. And I was like, it was good when you were in your 20s. And so I watched like 4 episodes.
My prediction, even your daughter's mother did not think that show held up.
No, she didn't. And she was correct that I was impressed with her costuming. But there was a scene pretty early on where she had to clip a blue wire.
And it was a clock with hands?
No, not with hands, but a digital clock. But
I like when the old ones, when they actually have hands.
Oh, yeah. But even Roger Moore in The Spy Who Loved Me had a digital clock.
What's the first one that has a digital one that stops on 007? It happens in Diamonds Are Forever, but I think it happens in Goldfinger?
Has to be Diamonds Are Forever is the first one.
Maybe it happens in Goldfinger.
Stops.
I just like the ones that actually have hands, because those were the days where you would just throw it in a body of water, and that's how you solve it. You don't need to be like, cut the wire. Just throw it in a body of water.
Yeah, because it has like some lead acid batteries attached to it. You just take the batteries out. Save the world.
It does tie into the most universal fear we have, which is our alarm clock going off every morning.
Yeah.
The sound that everybody hates and recoils against.
That's right.
So they shouldn't have gone digital. There should be a little, like a very small acute angle is scary to us. I guess this is the engine of the Doomsday Clock, right?
It is,
That we don't like little acute angles.
No, well, that's...
Because it means we're going to have to wake up. Or, in this case, die.
Die forever. Well, think about that. Midnight. As a metaphor for death and the end.
The witching hour.
That's it.
'Tis now the very witching hour of night. Like, midnight was always the scary time when, I guess the idea is God goes to bed? God closes up the shop?
Is that right?
Well, it's implied that that's when the ghosts and the goblins all get up and prance. Do they prance?
What?
Well, I mean, there's two schools of thought. They could be doing mean things, or they could just be cavorting.
Dum, 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 ba-dum, dum, dum.
Is this a skeleton dance?
Yeah, skeleton dance.
I'm playing ribs like a xylophone here. But they could be doing both. They could be cavorting in a menacing way. But I think the idea is at midnight, this is when you don't want to be near a cemetery.
Sure, black cats and so forth.
But look out.
How does that equate with your old theory about the double sleep where people are waking up in the middle of the night and cavorting in a different way?
I think you miss midnight.
Ba-doom, ba-doom, ba-doom,
ba-doom. You go to sleep. You sleep through the scary time.
I see.
When the skeletons are playing each other's ribs like a xylophone. And then as soon as the skeletons are all tuckered out and back in their beds, then Benjamin Franklin gets up and is like, I could use a snack.
Uh-huh.
Mayhaps I will put some of yesterday's salt pork on this piece of bread nigh to me and invent the sandwich. So that's what he says.
I see.
That's the kind of thing.
I can't wait till you do that episode. Ben Franklin invents the sandwich.
It's a little improv thing I've been working on.
You know, my whole life, my mom had, well, I mean, the number of apocryphal stories that she has could fill seven volumes. But one of them was, I don't know why, she said this to me many times in my life. You know, Ben Franklin was working for a long time on a way to make farts smell like roses.
Your mom just tells you this twice a day.
Well, I mean, you know.
How was school?
All you have to do is hear it four times in the course of 40 years, right. And it really sticks with you as like, huh.
But this is her thing. Whenever Benjamin Franklin comes up, she has a follow-up.
You know,
every time you fart, maybe?
I think it's part of her trying to describe like Enlightenment science. Mm. Like, oh, you know, it wasn't just that we stopped believing in transubstantiation. It was also that we were trying to make farts smell like roses. Like Ben Franklin is a genius.
Couldn't you use the steam engine as an example? Or penicillin?
He tied a key to a claw or to a kite and discovered electricity, but also failed at trying to make farts smell like roses.
This is an example of the limitations of the Enlightenment.
I think it might have come up less frequently when Ben Franklin came up and more frequently when farts, you know, somebody would fart.
I mean, it's true that somebody, I mean,
sorry to say this word six or seven times, those of you who are triggered.
Those of you who are giggling.
Yeah.
I think, the average person must pass gas more often than we think about Ben Franklin today.
Yeah, but you know.
In his lifetime, maybe it was a tie.
There are some record-setting farts that happen in a person's life. I remember one in my seventh grade science class.
They're all in cars.
Cleared the room.
They're all in cars.
Can you remember? I'm sure you do. You can remember your top four experiences with farts.
Yeah, let me get out the list right here.
You keep it on your phone, I'm sure.
No, I got a paper copy right here. I cannot name my top 10, no.
I didn't say 10.
It would be other.
That'd be crazy to carry 10
it
around.
It would be one you hold against another person.
Or one that you victimized a bunch of people and you never lived it down.
No, it's a sense of pride.
Well, so that's how I feel about it, sure. Yeah,
exactly.
Like you hotbox a whole room and then you're a legend.
Yeah, but I don't think I should take credit for it. It wasn't really me, you know?
Yeah, that's right.
Credit to God. I have a holistic mind-body, but if there's a part of my body I don't control perfectly, I would say it's that.
It's that, yeah. Speaking of things we don't control perfectly.
Oh, look at that.
Do you remember the first time you became aware of the concept of the doomsday clock? Was it always present, or do you remember a time when it first kind of startled you into?
I think I thought the doomsday clock was fictional for a long time.
Right.
It's a
one might argue
it,
that it is even now. But, well, yeah. But go on.
I don't know this. Is there a physical clock somewhere? There is, right? No. Because they show people at a press conference moving hands, but that's just a visual aid that they immediately throw out after the press conference.
Yeah, the doomsday clock is really a graphic. It's a graphic that actually has an artist who designed it. If you look at the doomsday clock, you will never see an entire clock. It's always just the last 15 minutes of it. And so it's...
Well, that's actually a little more hopeful.
It's really a pie shape.
If they show the whole thing, then it's really like, oh no, we're done. Like, look how close to zero we are. But if you zoom in a little bit, you can see more, it's a little more granularity. Like, okay, there's some room to maneuver here.
A little more granular, right?
But for some reason, when I was in junior high, I don't think I had ever seen one of these, we're moving the doomsday clock news cycles, or I had missed the U.S. News and World Report that had a squib about The doomsday clock.
And it happens in January of every year.
So oh, it's a yearly thing.
It's once a year they move the clock.
So I had missed this somehow. And when it's mentioned as a plot device in Watchmen, in the Alan Moore comic Watchmen.
That's right. It occurs a lot there.
And so, because I don't know how well you know your Watchmen, but a small acute angle is very important to the plot. There's a clock ticking down to midnight in each of the 12 issues. Mm-hmm. But there's also, a round symbol with a diagonal slash on it also symbolizes other things. There's a 70s smiley face that gets blood splashed on it in the very first panel.
Sure.
So that kind of, it's like a visual motif throughout the thing. And this is almost a comic book trope that's getting invented right now. Like movies had used this, but it was very exciting to see it in comics. And so it's a plot point that as the world is ticking down to what seems to be a Cold War nuclear annihilation, Nixon's still president in his fourth term and things are getting bad in this parallel universe. Every issue ends with a clock ticking down to midnight. And it's a plot point, I think, in one of the early issues that scientists are setting the doomsday clock. It's not January, so it's a little anachronistic. I don't know. In times of great urgency, do scientists ever meet at a different month to set the doomsday clock? Because imagine that wasn't the Cuban Missile Crisis in October?
It was.
So the doomsday clock is still stuck at where it was like 10 months ago. Well, there's nothing we can do. I mean, if the Earth ends next week, we will, I guess, never get to move it to zero. It'll just be a big jump.
In fact, that is how it goes. The doomsday clock has moved from 1947 to the present. Can you tell us how many years that is? Math whiz. From 47 to now.
Well, currently it's about 76.
76 years.
Is that right? No.
No. Well,
yeah, no, that's right.
76, yeah. In those 76 years, the clock has moved only 25 times.
So some years they're just like, we're too busy.
Or some years they're like, yeah, I mean, although another year has passed.
More or less it.
Everything's still cooking along. Things balance out.
I bet those are years when they forgot about it.
Well, they meet...
They were just got lazy. They met at some hotel somewhere. They were all drinking at the mixer. And at the end of the thing, they're like, oh, we never moved the clock. And then they give a press conference where they're like, this year we have determined that the risk of annihilation is exactly mathematically the same as it was last January at this time.
Am I right? Am I right? High five, high five, high five. Let's leave it.
If an obviously hungover scientist.
No, I'm sure that somebody's in a closet going, God, where's that clock graphic? Well, I can't find it. Let's just leave it.
It's blowing my mind already that there's not a real clock with movable hands, like the kind that a second grade teacher would use to teach kids to tell time.
I think over the years, they haven't used the exact same poster board with a pinned on second hand.
It's getting beat up by now. Some Eisenhower era piece of tag board.
And like you say, if it had been invented during a digital age, they might have even had a 24-hour clock.
Right.
And we could have a digital countdown. But
there is something nice about the visual.
Yeah.
The acute angle.
It's part of the thing.
Two contacts that are about to meet. And when they do, that completes the circuit. And then the five sticks of dynamite in John's trunk. Look out.
The end. The origin of the doomsday clock, as you can imagine. Well, let's see. Can you imagine? Where do you think the doomsday clock originated?
Well, you just said 1947, which gives me a big hint. Like, if you had told me it was a post-Cuban Missile Crisis thing, I think I would have believed it. But it's clearly the invention of the atomic bomb and a bunch of concerned scientists who have all become death destroyer of worlds, and now they feel a little bit bad about it. Because in most jobs, if you're like, hey, I've become death destroyer of worlds, it's not a good thing. Like,
well, I don't know. If you worked in a warehouse and suddenly you were death destroyer of worlds.
I don't think your boss is going to be stoked on your performance review.
No, but I know a lot of guys that work in warehouses, and they would almost all be psyched.
To become Death Destroyer of Worlds.
Dude, I'm Death Destroyer of Worlds.
I'm getting in the forklift.
Woo! That's me.
But now let's say, see, I'm thinking of this from management. Right. I'm the guy who plays insurance on the forklift. I don't want Death Destroyer of Worlds driving the forklift.
I see what you're saying. Yeah, right. No, from a management perspective, no, you'd like that to be retained by management, that power.
Yeah, I apologize for siding with management. Yeah, I want capital. I want the capital class to be the destroyer of worlds, like we always have been.
It turns out, depending on what your layer is, that's where you want Death Destroyer of Worlds to reside.
But these scientists have second thoughts about becoming Destroyer of Death Destroyer of Worlds.
Well, the movement behind this actually started during the war. You know, the scientists that were working within the Manhattan Project were not all, specifically Fermis and Oppenheimers. They weren't all physicists. The Manhattan Project brought a lot of scientists together to work on the overall project because it wasn't just singularly directed at developing a bomb. There were atomic energy. They were developing the whole realm of harnessing the atom. And among those scientists were biophysicists and chemists and, you know, people from across the what we would call the hard sciences, the lower campus, as we at the University of Washington would say, lower campus scientists, not upper campus scientists who are like...
If for some reason a sea monster rises out of the Montlake Cut, it'll kill them. Or maybe the physicists are more, maybe they have the death ray down there.
That's the thing. They're the bulwark against the sea monsters, at least at our college.
So are you saying that... The biochemists were nicer than the Fermis and the Oppenheimers?
No, they were all, you know, they're all scientists. They sit around doing science talk. There's a lot of slap and tickle. There's a lot of, you know, spanks as they walk past in the hall.
Probably.
Little football style spanks.
Back then it was okay. It wasn't even gay. It was just a good time at Los Alamos.
But by the middle of 1945, war is still raging in Japan or in the South Pacific. And it's clear to the scientists that the bomb is imminent. And also, I think a lot of them, it was not difficult for them to see, even in a pre-nuclear age, some of the threats that loomed as a result of what was about to happen.
It wouldn't take a whole lot of imagination to picture that, right?
They could see...
We just made a weapon 1,000 times worse than any other weapon. Could this change things?
And they could see or foresee an arms race and the threat that introduced to civilization. And this was, you know, the 20th century was a time when all of a sudden we had machines that were capable of mass destruction at a level that, you know, during World War I, it was the machine gun that revolutionized. I mean, you could kill dozens, but by the end of World War II...
You need a clock for that.
Yeah, that's right. By the end of World War II, there was, you know, we had established the concept of mass destruction that wasn't God bringing a plague upon the land. It was mankind having surpassed their moral capacity.
Surpassed God.
That's right. With your poison gas and your machines and your destruction from the air.
Newfangled tanks and whatnot.
We had become death, destroyer of worlds. So this group of concerned scientists got together and wrote what became known as the Frank Report. And
guy named Frank, or they're just very, very candid?
Frank. Oh, okay. F-R-A-N-C-K.
They're not just saying this is a very hard-hitting, candid report.
No, and it wasn't like, hey, the metaphor is hot dogs. Like,
yeah, was not my guess.
How far into this hot dog are we as a race of people?
Because it could have been anything. It doesn't have to be a clock.
It's just a little tiny hot dog. That's all that's left. The game is only half over.
Because that's something else you're afraid of is running out of something in your fridge or bathroom.
Exactly. What if it was the empty fridge of destruction?
There's nothing but a jar of olives left. We're all going to die.
There's like three kinds of mustard and...
Or what if it's a toothpaste tube just rolled up painfully high?
You're going to brush your teeth once, maybe twice, and then it's gone.
That's all you get.
But the Frank Report said a couple of things. And specifically, it said that nuclear power should be under civilian control, not military control, which was, I think, a crucial and not necessarily foregone conclusion, but a crucial thing to advocate for. If you can imagine all nuclear-related industry being controlled by the military.
They're already envisioning it as a possible energy industry.
Absolutely. And I think for a lot of them, that was the saving grace. They weren't trying to make a bomb. They were trying to make
the power of the future.
The power of the future, exactly. A utopian power. And in light of that, the other proposal of the Frank Report was we should not ever use this power, this bomb that we're standing here with our hands on. We should not use this bomb against anyone. What the United States should do is bring the heads of state of all the powers of the world, the proto-United Nations, put them all on a cruise ship, let's say, take them out to Bikini Atoll, and set off a bomb where everybody can see it. And witnessing it, the leaders of the world would recognize there was no way to counter this. There was no, it was a power beyond imagination, and it would bring an end to all war.
Wow. One sufficiently good show and tell.
That's right.
Changes human nature.
Bring them all to the desert somewhere. You pick the desert, leaders of the world.
And clearly none of their eyes will light up at the thought of a no. of a powerful new weapon. Because these are all the leaders of the world.
Yeah.
They're the sanest and best and the brightest, or they wouldn't be the, king of Greece or whatever.
Exactly. If you think about it, who is saner and more rational than Stalin?
Yeah, than a politician, right?
Like they're going to... Stalin's going to look at that and go like, wow, I'm so glad the United States has those.
We should not get one of those.
Safe hands.
Those seem bad and dangerous.
But this is a thing within science. There is a lot of utopianism. It's maybe a thing that you want a scientist to have.
Maybe it's why they got into it, right?
That's right. And so the idea that you could... Well, and the idea that people are rational actors, and that if you showed them this incredible destructive power and said, there's only one of these, so don't test us, weirdos, that people's natural sense of self-preservation would override their desire for fame and conquest and power.
You're asking a group of people on an aircraft carrier or whatever, like, hey, do you think the world should end?
Right.
You should get unanimity on that question. We all agree that the world should not end.
That's right.
But it turns out it's a little more complicated than that.
And unfortunately, depending on how you count, depending on where your doomsday clock is, the Truman administration weighed the options and said, boy, it would be so hard to get everybody out there on an aircraft carrier, all like, the catering alone.
Let's do a Zoom call.
So we're actually going to drop these on Japan, and that's going to be both our demonstration and also hopefully the end of the war with Japan. And so the
kill two birds.
The Frank Report came out in June, and Hiroshima was bombed in August. So there was that period where the scientists still kind of held the reins. It had yet the bomb and the concept of harnessing this atom to such great destructive power. Had 2 months there where the scientists were like, look. It's not too late.
It is interesting to imagine all these people thinking, this clearly this will never be used on civilians, thank goodness.
Well, or we see it very definitely could be, but we're the scientists.
We can turn that aside.
Listen to the science. So
unfortunately, Truman did his own research.
Yeah, Truman was like, I get you. But yeah, also—
Truman's the Joe Rogan in
the
story.
The generals are saying— So one of the scientists from the Manhattan Project was a biophysicist by the name of Eugene Rabinovich, and he had spent his career and then continued to spend the remainder of his career all the way into the 1970s studying photosynthesis. And he was very interested in solar power and in, he really advanced our knowledge of photosynthesis, both as a way of generating power, but also a way of generating oxygen. Like, he was a leading scientist. And part of the Manhattan Project, as, a component of the fairly wide diversity of scientists that were involved.
It's hard to think what photosynthesis has to do with the Manhattan Project, but okay.
Yeah, well, you put a bunch of, it's hard to know what I was doing on the Seattle Music Commission. Why the hell was I even running for city council? I didn't belong there. Eugene Rabinovich probably didn't belong in the Manhattan Project, but there he was.
Yeah, he's like the special guest star.
And he was a University of Chicago person. And as you know, a lot of the scientist, a lot of the science coming out associated with the Manhattan Project was from Chicago. It's
Fermi and those guys.
Yeah, a lot of Chicago guys. And so...
Jeff Tweedy, I think.
Jeff Tweedy was there.
A lot of people don't know that.
The cast of The Bear, at least for the outdoor scenes, were there. So Eugene and a group of kind of core Manhattan Project concerned scientists, including Albert Einstein, who, if he's in any way associated with anything that anyone is doing, his name goes right at the top, right? Einstein is always...
You got to put that guy in your letter, yeah, biggest, like, type.
If I were to write a thing, it would be called the Roderick paper, but if Einstein walked in the room at any time, you'd call it the Roderick Einstein paper.
Well, your Einstein number would be one. Would That's be one. Good.
That's right. So they started a group called the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. It was initially a bulletin.
But the idea is it's not a bulletin for atomic scientists, it's a bulletin from atomic scientists.
With the idea of communicating to a newly very curious world. I mean, the world is curious, but also within the world, the people are curious about nukes, the bomb, the power. You know, most of the people in the world went from not knowing anything about it to suddenly wanting to know everything about it. And this was the group of scientists that knew the most about it. And what they wanted to do and believed was possible was educating the people about both the benign powers of harnessed nukes and also the great and grave danger to civilization that nukes presented.
Got it.
So the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists was a newsletter that promoted, honestly, had a very political agenda. And the political agenda was explicitly described as an effort to preserve civilization by scaring men into rationality.
Oh, so that's, they don't even say that part quietly.
No.
They just say, the most important thing we can do is scare people about atomic power.
Yeah, and I think it probably came from the very real fear that these people who had their hands in the pot felt about what they had made.
And the sense that there's millions of people out here who are not going to get it. Like, we're the only ones who can get this across.
And that fear is going to be the thing that keeps us from misusing this. That the recognition that this could spiral out of control, out of our hands, in so many ways. And initially, it was, you know, they wanted the use of the nukes to not be taken lightly. I think once we saw what happened in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, everybody got the message really fast that this was not a thing that made any sense to use ever again, really. Having seen it, it did have the effect that they hoped they could do without murdering people. Most of the people of the world did see, like, there aren't a lot of use cases for this.
Forget that we just ended a terrible war with it and said that was good.
Yeah.
It's important to think the next time it might not be so useful.
It's not a thing to start a war with, let's call it that. And definitely it seems, what scale, like the argument using it in Japan was that it actually saved hundreds of thousands of lives that would have resulted from an American invasion of Japan.
And that was maybe not even an argument you would have to make at the time. You would just say, well, we made the other boys surrender. And that's
right.
That's what the American population wanted to hear.
Yeah. And I think a lot of Americans still feel that way. I mean, there are people around the world. There are a lot of people that wouldn't doubt the use of it. If you look at it and say, like, well, what would it cost in lives and material to the Japanese alone, to have the American army come and make every single individual person surrender, it's not going to be easy. But since that time, has there ever been a global conflict where you're like,
boy, I think it might be nukes here.
if we took out a city, that might really end the Suez Crisis. But is that, you know, on the same scale? And that's part of one of the arguments of nuclear deterrence is just that, well, we haven't had a world war since. And maybe, I mean, what role do all these nukes play in that?
Without nukes,
impossible to determine.
At least two world wars.
Two global conflagrations.
But now we've got the big sign that says it has been 78 years since
since our last nuclear war, or since our last war.
Since a world war.
Global war. But then very quickly, as other countries, you know, as the Soviets exploded their first bomb, and then, you know, the prospect of proliferation was introduced, then the whole idea that nuclear conflict was kind of inevitable, because once you have, you know, once it's out of its lockbox, if the Soviets can get it, well, certainly the Chinese can, and then the French, and then pretty soon you have bombs in Serbia.
Well, the French is already the worst case scenario.
See,
that's what you could scare middle America with.
I couldn't agree more.
The French have the bomb, and it's only like 1950, whatever.
So even very early, there was that other component that wasn't just superpower politics. It wasn't just the saber rattling between the U.S. and the Soviets. It was an acknowledgement that proliferation was one of the grave dangers. In fact, I mean, Oppenheimer had already proposed a suitcase bomb in the mid 40s, like immediately after the war. He already said
he's already trying to improve it.
Somebody one day is going to be able to throw one of these together out of spare parts and blow up a city. Like he's
not proposing it like, let's make one.
No.
He's trying to scare us with it. I thought he was pitching the Pentagon. Sharks, I've got an idea.
Oppenheimer made a suitcase.
Fat man and little boy, but smaller. We'll call it briefcase boy.
No, he could. He was trying to foresee and imagine. I don't think he thought all the way through to like terrorism, but just that it would be possible.
But he's getting close. Yeah, like, if it's that small, a non-state actor.
And it was pre-ICBM. So he's trying to imagine, well, how are the Russians going to take out Chicago? Oh, well, they would just put one of these together in a briefcase and send a guy on a Pan Am flight. But, during that time, like de Gaulle said that no country could be considered truly independent if they didn't have nukes. Kennedy predicted...
It's a bummer for the Vatican.
See? I mean, think about it. It's a bummer for the Dutch. They don't have any nukes.
I feel like the Dutch could get nukes before the Vatican.
They could. And we'll get to that in a second. But Kennedy predicted that by 1964, there might be as many as 20 countries with nuclear weapons. So there was... So the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists was trying to describe all of this threat, and they came up with this clock metaphor. Not in 45, it took them a couple of years. It was 47 when they arrived at this sort of this concept that what we need to do to really drive this home with people is to show them graphically how close we are to Armageddon. And the clock image, which is as a graphic, it's a mid-century masterpiece.
It's real Don Draper stuff.
It's good stuff. And it was designed by Martel Langsdorff.
Is that a firm or a guy?
It's a lady.
Ooh. All my assumptions have just come crashing down.
They have.
A lady Don Draper.
And she actually was married to a physicist who worked on the Manhattan Project. And she designed this clock. And... It debuted at 7 minutes to midnight.
Seems a little arbitrary.
And it
was there any justification?
It like, debuted at 7 minutes to
are
midnight.
Are there benchmarks? What's half an hour?
Because Martel said it looked good to her eye.
Well.
So
that's not how science works, Martel.
So
if that is your real name or indeed a name at all.
We start at 7 minutes to midnight. Because the graphic was cool.
It conveys the right kind of urgency. And but it doesn't give you much room to maneuver.
Well, that's the thing. Initially, they did not think, oh, man, this is going to be basically the signature look of the Bulletin of Atomic Science.
And it's not even a metric. It's just a single symbol of how dire things are.
And it was designed as the cover of an issue of the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists.
I always just turned straight to the word search at the back, so maybe I didn't see this.
Yeah, no, I go to the back and fold the pages together to see the little fold in. Yeah.
They had recipes.
And then to the center fold, of course. But the graphic was, it looks like an academic journal for mass consumption designed in 1947. It's super cool looking. They didn't think, we should make a clock and like have a press conference every year. That came after they saw the impact of this graphic. And so in 47, it was set at 7 minutes. And by 1949... So in 48, they kind of were still trying to figure out, like, is this, maybe we should, you know, they didn't give a press conference in
49 is when it becomes a going concern.
Yeah. Because then they reset it to 3 minutes.
What happened in 48?
Well,
didn't the Russians already have the bomb in 47?
49 was when the U.S. first exploded a hydrogen bomb and the Russians got the bomb.
Oh, it is 49. Okay.
So 49, it went to 3. And by 53, actually, I guess in 53, we had the hydrogen bomb. 49 was when the Russians exploded their bomb. By 53, at the explosion of the hydrogen bomb, it went to what would for 5 decades be its closest to Armageddon, which was 2 minutes to midnight, as enshrined in the famous Iron Maiden song, 2 minutes to midnight.
But this just seems like kind of an artifact of not having the whole system worked out yet. Like, I don't know if anybody would say that 1949 was a more was the most dire, you know, as closest we ever came to nuclear annihilation.
Well, that's the thing. And you see it kind of bounce around quite a bit. We saw the hydrogen bomb, the development of it, and in 53, it really did seem like, you know, if you believe Donald Fagan, his faulty memory or his, you know, maybe unreliable memory, this was the 53 was all of the bomb shelters and all of the Levittown people running around.
Duck and cover.
Yeah. Still thinking that we could get out of the cities in time. I mean, ICBMs were still not really, we still had bombers with propellers on them.
So are they every year, like when they move it back, are they kind of reacting to, is it a way to applaud different kinds of geopolitical events? Like, boy, we sure like this statement by the president or the Politburo, and so therefore we've decided this year it moves back? Because you kind of boxed yourself in creatively once you're at 2 minutes to midnight.
You have.
In the first few years of the institution.
You have, and the thing about the late 50s is that it was not a time without crisis. Right in 56, there was the Suez Crisis. Mm-hmm. There was the Taiwan Strait Crisis and the crisis in Lebanon in 58. But the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists looked at those crises and saw that they were resolved politically.
So it's a good thing,
right,
that these things that could have become Cold War flashpoints did not.
Right, and so in kind of reflecting the peaceful resolution and the lack of escalation that happened, although these were, you know, global crises, and including the fact that France got their own bomb in 1960. So proliferation ongoing as predicted, but in 1960, the clock moved back to 7 minutes to midnight. So the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, which is a group that's, you know, increasingly kind of coalescing as atomic scientists, but then there's also kind of a advisory board of scientists that are across several disciplines. You know, what they're trying to do is get an advisory board of science-minded, of eminent scholars who are
they're like World Book Encyclopedia.
Right. They don't want the Board of Atomic Scientists to just be a bunch of deep in the weeds people that are exclusively concerned with the bomb itself. They want advice from people that are engaged in politics, global affairs, and, you know, and the realm of science.
Am I right that this is what we would consider today to be kind of the activist arm of the atomic scientists? Like, we're not seeing a representative sampling of what all these scientists think, because we're getting the ones that are the most concerned about these issues.
Well, this is the sort of trigger alert moment in the show when I say, when I reaffirm to the sentient sea slugs who are listening to this show deep in the future, and also the sentient sea slugs of 2023 who are listening to it now.
They're ancestors.
That's right.
You don't know this, but once humanity blows itself up, you're it.
You're it.
Good luck.
Your children's children. I want to reaffirm my belief in climate science, and I think I speak for you when I say that climate science is compatible with the Omnibus Project.
All kinds of science.
I do believe in science.
Except for like race science.
I know you believe in science. Phrenology, we have over here. It's in the outbox.
It's not even controversial. We're unabashedly pro-science.
And the problem then with saying that science can be politicized is that that's a talking point that's often used to discredit the conclusion of groups of scientists that we generally feel like can speak authoritatively about, right? We don't want to ever make a blanket statement about the reliability of groups of scientists, but it is important to this project and to everyone to acknowledge that scientists are not always apolitical, and
probably not ever apolitical, right?
Probably not ever apolitical.
And maybe you don't want them to be, you know?
I think you don't, but it's a rhetorical issue in our current culture that scientists often present themselves, and they did even, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists wanted to have the gloss of neutrality. Yeah.
They're not the Bulletin of Leftist Scientists, right, or Peacenik Scientists.
We're not saying, you know, there are even Republicans that believe that nuclear bombs are bad. it's a bipartisan effort. But, of course, science can lead you to differing conclusions. And yes, this group of scientists is concerned. It's a group of concerned scientists. I'm sure there were plenty of nuke scientists that were like, the bomb is what's keeping us safe.
The unconcerned scientists. Things are mostly good. Let's have a cookout.
The Bulletin of Scientists Concerned About Other Stuff.
I feel like if you're unconcerned, you just don't even make a bulletin. You're so unconcerned, you don't have a zine.
Well, you would be wrong, because the press is full of people that are very concerned about the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists being being inflammatory.
So do they get pushback from the beginning?
Oh yeah. I mean, there's always going to be somebody that says alarmism is the enemy of close thought, right? Alarmism, To motivate men by fear is intrinsically dangerous.
If this was a business seminar and somebody asked me, should we motivate our organization by fear? I think everyone would agree, no. On the other hand, if you're like, I don't know, if you're trying to get people out of a burning building, do you say,
hey, there's coffee for everybody.
I think
on the ground floor.
Do you really appeal to the better angels of people's nature? Or can you just be like, really, for self-preservation, let's all move towards the stairwell?
Listen up. There are presents in the fire truck. Make your way. This is a good question, and one that we confront more and more in our present day, which we'll get to in a second. The idea of alarmism and maybe exaggerating the risk in order to galvanize and motivate people into action.
Yeah.
Right? It's very difficult to say. And the tendency of people is always to say, well, the people in charge are surely going to take care of this. Right? And it's not just head in the sand, like, I don't want to think about this. It's a general, I mean, very informed people can believe, well, there are top men who are going to decide what to do with this Ark of the Covenant, and so we'll just let it, you know, There's one concerned scientist in a fedora.
Even adventure-loving Indiana Jones just shrugs and walks down the Capitol steps with Marianne.
He puts his hands in his pockets and like, those guys don't even know what they've got.
It's because we're pack animals, right? You know, we descended from... It's very deep in the human character to think, this will probably be okay. And I've seen studies on, you know, who survives disasters, and it's the people who somehow get over that or who are not inclined to be like, I'm going to wait to be told what to do.
I'm going to wait and see if this Titanic doesn't refloat itself.
It's the people who, yeah, who immediately start trying to fashion a crude raft out of doors that actually survive.
Yeah, it's that. And also, I mean, in fascist societies, you are discouraged from contributing to, from feeling like you're part of the decision-making process. But in democratic societies, we have, it's right there in the name, or I mean, at least in electoral democratic societies, you elect somebody as your representative. And if you have confidence in your congressman or your senator, and they tell you that things are fine, it is very tantalizing to think that Congress is capable, right?
That, and formerly more plausible, but
that the president and the Congress and the courts actually function. Well,
because it would make your life so much simpler.
Yeah.
If it's not true, you don't have a lot of alternatives. So it's confusing.
Yeah.
What to do if not.
Yeah. Right. And protest has taken many forms, democratic protest. I mean, again, in a fascist country, protest is very different, and you end up getting stuck with a radioactive umbrella a lot of the time.
A lot of the time. the median outcome,
you know what,
is getting polonium in your knee.
I get a newsletter called the newsletter of concerned polonium scientists, and you'd be surprised the number of people that die from polonium. Eugene Rabinovich edited the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists from 1945 until his death in 73. And his explanation of the purpose of the magazine, he had a little paragraph about it. He said it was to awaken the public to a full understanding of the horrendous reality of nuclear weapons and their far-reaching implications for the future of mankind, and to warn of the inevitability of other nations acquiring nukes within a few years of 1947.
Yeah.
And of the futility of relying on American possession of the secret of the bomb.
And this is before the secret has gotten out, but he was correct.
Right. Well, he was correct, but he was not as correct, you know, the number of,
because he ended up dying of natural causes and not of a not of a big flash of light.
Well, that, and also that in the you know, 7 decades since, the number of countries with nuclear weapons has remained more or less, I mean, we've added a few over, you know, since 1960. There are 9 countries in the world that have nuclear weapons: the U.S. and Russia, and then France, China, the United Kingdom, Pakistan, India, Israel, and then, in big scare quotes, North Korea. And I put those big scare quotes in there because North Korea is a rhetorical nuke holder, and they've set off some tests that are measurable. Actually, having a workable nuclear bomb is super hard technologically, just to keep them up and running and to get them somewhere and have them work is hard. And
that's why you and I don't have the bomb.
That's right.
It's not enough hours in the day.
It's why a lot of countries don't. And whether or not North Korea has actually the power to threaten even South Korea with nukes, let alone America.
Missiles, yeah.
It seems pretty doubtful.
And you know, aside from North Korea, aside from a rogue state like that, there are non-proliferation treaties.
Many, many, many.
Everybody kind of agreed, even though our nation doesn't have the bomb, we're okay with a world where we don't if our 10 regional neighbors also don't, right?
And this is one of the things about proliferation and the things about the kind of the feeling that throughout the Cold War that nuclear war was somewhat inevitable.
Yeah.
And that we were that although the clock kind of changed and ticked and talked this way and that, ultimately we all looked at midnight and felt like it was
midnight always comes.
It was looming. That's right. But the countries that could have that had the technology and the political capability to get nukes and didn't is a pretty long list. And right at the top of it is Canada. Canada could have had their own nukes before France, right? They were both technologically capable of it, and also the United States would have happily given Canada nukes if they wanted, and Canada didn't. They saw no reason to have them. And obviously, a lot of the countries on this list feel like they're generally protected by a NATO umbrella,
right,
or an American umbrella.
It's less urgency.
But that kind of gives the lie to the idea that owning nukes would give you a boost in international prestige, that it would make your country seem more formidable.
You could also read it, and I think this is not your reading, as the success of the concerned scientists. That they were able to say, that they were able to convince a critical mass of people in Canada and elsewhere that this is not an inevitable path for your nation.
Yes, although the work of the concerned scientists in the 40s and 50s was pretty small volumetrically compared to the flag waving and saber rattling and, you know, and fear mongering that was not fear mongering like, we're all going to die, you guys, we should stop this. It was fear mongering like, they're coming for us and we need
more bunkers and
more bunkers and more bombs, right? So
maybe Canadians are just more easily swayed by, you know, they love a small fan movement.
They do. They're very gentle people, as you know. But also Italy and Argentina and Brazil and South Korea.
Italians not so gentle.
And, I mean, profoundly, Taiwan.
Yeah.
All of these countries had, you know, a real either desire to be present on the national stage or to defend against genuine threat.
Regional threats.
And all of them kind of passed on the opportunity that although they had both the technology and probably the political wherewithal to develop a bomb, most of them passed on it. And the reason is that all the way back to 1945, it's clear that there is no real use case for the bomb. Canada's never going to use it. And having it would not increase Canada's prestige, right? Like if you think England has the bomb, but is England's...
Do they put it on the 10-pound note? They do not.
Would their prestige be any lower if, like Germany, they did not have the bomb? And again, there's the NATO umbrella that gives them a kind of, yeah. You know, Japan obviously does not have the bomb. Do we hold them in any less esteem than we do Israel that does have the bomb?
Possibly more.
Possibly more.
I mean, Taiwan is... Taiwan's in a country where, I mean, maybe there's real politic involved where, you know, we'd rather have the NATO umbrella and the $100 million or whatever it costs to not have the bomb, you know?
A lot, I think more than $100 million.
Yeah.
But also, the bomb did not stop the war in Korea. It didn't, you know, as a deterrent, it didn't stop, the United States having the bomb did not keep Vietnam from fighting the U.S. to a standstill, and it did not inhibit the Arab nations from invading Israel in 73. It didn't stop Argentina from fighting the U.K. in 82.
But this is weird to hear from you coming as a Gen Xer and implying that our primal fear of nuclear annihilation was alarmist, overblown, because...
It was ever-present, right, in our lives. But interestingly, as you mentioned before, by 1963, between 1960, when the clock was set at 7, And 1963, when it went to 12 minutes from midnight, there was a thing there right in the middle in 62 called the Cuban Missile Crisis.
And it got 5 minutes less dire.
I
guess because they're going to say it's because the Cuban Missile Crisis was resolved diplomatically.
But somewhere in there, we were at least, I mean, we were probably 14 seconds.
It's worse than 49, for sure.
And watching the clock move around and trying to relate it to what's happening in real world
geopolitics. It's unrelated. It's like the Dow and the economy now.
It's hard to, it's responding to things at a geopolitical level that are of particular concern to this group of scientists who are thinking about this problem in a certain way. Right? In 1963, there was the Partial Test Ban Treaty. And in 63, it went to 12. So the test ban treaty was a motivator.
And it's also their way of applauding a certain kind of whether that actually represents the real risk or not. It's more like, well, we want more things like this. So let's make a big show.
But in 68, the U.S. was deeply embroiled in Vietnam. There was an Indo-Pakistani conflict that had been ongoing, and the Six-Day War.
Right.
And in 69, it was at 10. So, yes, the idea that these were resolved without using nukes was maybe persuasive.
I assume that's offered as the justification.
But by 69, the world certainly seemed a lot closer to a global conflict than it had at any time probably prior to 1938, or probably post 1938, right? Was there a world more unstable than 68, 69? But at the time, I think, just the vernacular of danger, they were comparing it, I guess, to 53 and saying like, well, at least there's no, we're not actually like tip to tip.
And my guess is they're revealing that they're understanding that their clock has not been consistently calibrated, right?
Right.
There's no attempt to say it's five times more dangerous now than in 49. I think maybe you just can't do date-to-date comparisons like that because, again, it started out as an advertising logo.
Yeah, right. And I guess it depends also who's on your board.
Oh, yeah.
In 74, India got the bomb and the clock was at 9. In 1980, Carter bailed on the Olympics.
Afghanistan.
The USSR was in Afghanistan. In 80, it was at 7, but then Reagan gets elected and it goes to 4. Throughout most of the 80s, Reagan's rhetoric, of course, was the only solution to the Cold War is to win it. And so this was a period of great escalation of rhetoric and also an arms race, one.
So maybe the scientists were proved right, but it still does seem like a political provocation. It's like giving Obama the Nobel Peace Prize, right?
Right. And we'll see that we'll see that tendency increases.
Yeah.
Because in 84, the clock goes all the way to 3. And I remember 1984, as you probably do. It was definitely a tense geopolitical time. But in 88, there had been significant progress in arms control treaties, and Gorbachev was in the game, and the clock made a pretty dramatic 3-minute gain to 6 minutes. And this was an era when you could gain or lose 3 minutes in a couple of years.
I'm getting jet lag.
The Berlin Wall came down in 90, and the clock went to 10. And then in 91, the clock arrived at its furthest from doomsday. It was 17 minutes.
And this actually accords with what you and I might think of as a reasonable popular sense of when are we likely to get nuked.
Right. The USSR dissolved that year, and 17 minutes was our blissful time in the hammock.
And no forward-thinking atomic scientists are like, where are all these nukes going to go?
Well, there was a lot of that, and that then affects what happens in the next 20 years. It's interesting that the atomic scientists never have moved the clock further than 17 minutes, right? There's never been a time since World War II that we've been, say, 20 minutes from Armageddon.
Or it's just meaningless. Like, what even is the, again, what is the benchmark?
45 minutes.
Like I don't even know what the, because it could keep going back forever. Yeah. Like, you could say that it stops at an hour, but no, you could be 6 hours to midnight.
That's the thing.
It could be 10 in the morning.
There are 24 hours on a clock. I hope this isn't news to anyone. And we've never been further from, so it is, you know, like, you kind of see at that moment, like, oh, yeah, this is a rhetorical device that kind of relies on relies on panic as a motivator. And
it doesn't have to be panic.
Well, but
it could be disquiet,
it's
or
a little, 20 minutes might be disquiet. Like 17 is still I would be panicking.
It's true.
If you had given me 24 hours to solve this problem and I only had 17 minutes left. Right.
Like preparing the show.
That's right. I'm still doing it even now. By 95, the idea of post-Soviet proliferation of nukes, which is to say rogue scientists missing nuclear bombs, this had gotten into our imagination.
Breakaway republics.
And whether or not, and what actually happened was, Belarus, Ukraine, Kazakhstan actually gave their nukes back rather than, if Ukraine had maintained itself as a nuclear power.
It would be very interesting 2023.
It would. And there are arguments on both sides, right? We would be either closer to a nuclear conflict or the deterrence would have kept the Russians from ever doing it. It certainly would make Putin's saber rattling look and feel a lot different.
Yeah.
But then that idea of the rogue scientist and the rogue bomb remains with us ever since the mid-90s. It's never not on the minds of the nuclear scientists, even though there's very little evidence for any missing nukes.
It's interesting that nothing has happened. I mean, you can't argue with the fact that it's now been 30 years and nothing has happened.
And again, the science of actually maintaining a bomb and getting it to work is incredibly hard. Right, you have to maintain nukes. They're delicate. But also, setting one off is not just a question of connecting a digital clock to it with some wires. And the triggering mechanisms of nukes, the science of that is not nuclear science. The politics of it is not, that information is not held by two guys in jumpsuits with keys that you could bribe, right? To set the bomb off is its own technological challenge. So even if a bomb had escaped from somewhere in
Uzbekistan
and was now floating around, it would be large, first of all, hard to conceal. The fact that it was missing would not have gone unnoticed. There would be a global search for it. And also, it's not just like, oh, we got this guy with a patch over his eye and he tells me that we can set it off with his, little gizmo made of Legos. It's like a scientific challenge that surpasses any rogue state.
And even one of our doomsday scenarios, the dirty bomb in the suitcase in Trafalgar Square or whatever, that's not necessarily a midnight event.
No.
It would be terrible.
Yes.
It would be the worst thing to happen in the world in decades, but it's not what the clock is counting to.
No,
it's not going to lead to an exchange of ICBMs.
It wouldn't even destroy London, right? Dirty bomb would just poison London
it's
or a portion.
It's an umbrella
of it.
To the knee to a bigger order of magnitude.
Likewise, the proliferation of quote unquote states like Pakistan, where we identify within the Pakistani government a lot of sympathy for groups that we equate with terrorism and Al-Qaeda ultimately. But within Pakistan and the government, there's very little incentive to let go of control over those bombs. It doesn't matter how unstable the leader is, because as soon as you hand a bomb over to someone else, you have no way of keeping them from using it against you, right? Pakistan gives a bomb to the Taliban almost certainly the first thing Taliban would do is use it against Pakistan. It's just the nature of the narcissism of minor differences.
And you don't want to give it to someone close to you anyway.
Exactly.
You know? This is the farting in a car problem.
And as I said earlier, when you think about the fear around the bomb falling into the hands of a madman, you could make the case that there was no madman madder than Stalin.
Right, you got to be worse than
unless it's Mao, right? Both of these guys murdered tens and tens of millions of people through famine and execution.
And had nukes.
And had some of the big, big, big nukes. And also were deeply paranoid, like crazy people, and never found a reason or a justification where using a nuke was even ever really on the table.
But the other side is what you might call the IRA Thatcher problem, which is, you know, you have to be right about this every time.
Yeah.
The Bureau of Concerned Scientists only have to be concerned once,
that's
you
right.
know, and that's still, that could be the thing.
The two
madmen from before didn't do it, but you know, like what nationalist guy in India is going to be the guy who does it, you know?
It's true. I am not advocating for no awareness or...
You're in favor of nuclear annihilation. We get it.
Around the idea of nuclear proliferation. It's just that the rhetoric has kind of relied on assumptions about how things were going to go, most of which did not come to pass. Now, whether...
I still feel like I'm the rhetoric worked guy. You know?
The rhetoric works.
Maybe, you know, like...
If you think...
You think there's systemic things that would have limited nukes anyway, but maybe, you know...
I think...
Maybe the rhetoric has a bigger part.
The influence of the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists...
But a larger peace movement.
You're talking about the peace movement.
Yeah.
Yeah. Even the peace movement probably didn't like intrude on the consciences of the
of Mao
of Mao, right? Or the people in
he's like, all these people go around carrying pictures of me, but they're not going to make it with anyone anyhow.
A good example is one of the primary justifications for the invasion of Iraq was the global community putting a stop to what was being presented Saddam's like,
what if he gets fissionable material?
And that's what he's working toward. Iraq is the country that's next going to get the bomb. It's going to destabilize the whole area. And that war was initiated. And at the time, everyone believed that this was a war against proliferation. And it turned out that Iraq, their nuclear program was three soup cans tied together with string.
But the whole Security Council was willing to go with,
that's
like,
right.
We all agree.
Here it is. We've got the evidence right here. And as you will notice, looking at all of the rhetoric surrounding Iran, it's always about their, you know, the fact that they're 7 minutes away from having the bomb. And once they have the bomb, it will be an inevitable, you know, the clock will go to zero and the world will come apart.
Unless you've looked at any previous example, that's right, of how, exactly. how that didn't happen when Pakistan got the bomb or exactly. Stalin got the bomb.
And so the rhetoric does, as often as not, actually precipitate war and conflict. Like Israel had the bomb, it has not made the Middle East either explode or any safer, really.
Yeah.
Right? So a lot of what we assume is going to result from either responding to that, to the catastrophization, or ignoring it, neither thing is really, the needle really isn't moved. It's, and in a way, it's a positive comment on how we are.
Yeah, human nature.
How we are rational.
Or at least how our systems are currently set up.
What we've seen, though, in very recent years is that the concerned scientists of the Atomic Bulletin have started to recognize that there are greater threats to the globe and greater risk of catastrophe from other things besides nuclear proliferation. And in 2007... they started to include climate change in terms of the doomsday clock.
And this is a big change because up until now, it's purely been a measure of nuclear holocaust.
And holocaust that was going to be the result of technological advance. So there was a sense that you could include things like
germ weapons.
And human-caused famines. I mean, there were other things being taken.
Oh, okay.
But all within an umbrella of geopolitics. But now climate change was a new concept that it was technological and that science was playing a role in it, but that it was a different kind of ticking bomb.
But they're atomic scientists.
They're atomic scientists.
Stay in your lane, atomic scientists.
So it was in 2002, it was at 7, and the needle didn't move from 2002 to 2007. And then in 2007, it dropped 2 minutes to 5 minutes when they added the concept of climate change. And since that time, it has almost exclusively dropped. But from 2010 to 2017, if you read the bulletin's justification, which they use every year, it was a brand new way of thinking because the clock continued to lose time, but the explanation was generally that there was a lack of action.
Trends are continuing.
Yeah.
Shouldn't that have been baked into last year's number?
Stuff is still, we have not done anything about this, so we're losing a minute.
Also, you can't keep losing a minute because you're going to do it 5 times at this point.
So by 2016, although, you know, geopolitics were kind of like in 2011 after the after 9/11, the clock didn't really register it.
It would have been unpatriotic.
Yeah, that's right.
We were in flyovers of over Shea Stadium. You know,
doubt the president.
You don't want to move a clock.
But by 2016, it was at 3 minutes, and this is over a time where climate is now stepping forward to take a larger role in the way that we describe it. And when Trump was elected, they, for the first time, introduced a fraction of a minute.
They got too close.
It went to
They got too close, John. You were right.
That's right. They couldn't keep going down by a minute.
17 minutes could not be the best of all possible worlds.
So in 2017, it went to 2.5 minutes. And this was mostly just a response to Trump's hyperbole. Because the following year in 2018.
But that's not, you think that's related more to war and geopolitics, or it's. Or did they explicitly link it to he's bad on the environment?
Well, no, it was more that it was just his sort of blanket rejection of science in climate and politics.
Yeah. So right? They didn't break it out.
He was just creating a less stable world. And it stayed at 2 through his presidency. And one might think that the election of Joe Biden would have arrested this because Joe Biden renewed his commitment to nuclear treaties. He renewed his commitment or America's commitment to
Kyoto and carbon reduction,
climate action. And also, you know, but in fact, the Biden administration, according to the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, has only deepened the crisis because, again, the climate bomb is that the action isn't happening fast enough. And COVID introduced a new idea that a global pandemic might bring us closer to the end. And so in 2020, it went to 100 seconds.
Oh, now it's in seconds.
And it stayed at 100 seconds through 2021 and 2022. And then this year, because of the war in Ukraine and Putin actually explicitly threatening the world with nukes.
This seems more in their wheelhouse.
We're now at the very closest we've ever been to Armageddon since 1947. We're 90 seconds away. And the
Cuban Missile Crisis, again, was what, like 8 minutes or something?
Cuban Missile Crisis We were, yeah.
I know it was between readings.
Between 7 and 12 minutes away.
And now we're 100 seconds.
We're 90 seconds. And the climate, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists actually describes us now as at doom's doorstep.
I mean, the argument against this kind of thing, which I'm sure you will make, is that people get panic fatigue. You know, these guys were telling us, it's not even Boy Who Cried Wolf, it's just they've been using exaggerated rhetoric for a long time, and, you know, when it doesn't actually match up with people's observable reality, they're gonna reject it. It's not gonna actually lead to action.
Well, and this is the issue that we are kind of facing in the moment, and in particular, we're kind of in a moment in the conversation around climate change where
I'm not saying people are not thinking about climate change too much. Like it's
no,
like we're too assertive about it. Obviously more needs to be done,
but this is an argument about the rhetorical power of anxiety-inducing rhetoric.
Right. There's also the bigger question of what the end of the world means in regard to climate change. Surely it just means a lot of upheavals, migrations, famines, etc., that are not synonymous with nuclear winter.
Right. The clock used to mean that at midnight, the world would end.
Essentially, population and society are done, whereas climate change is more likely to lead to a long and painful shift.
So now we're 90 seconds away from the beginning of a 100-year cycle of catastrophe that produces an end that we can't really begin to describe or imagine.
Yeah, we can't model.
But what we have now is actually like a syndrome that has been introduced into the psychological canon. I don't know if it's in the DSM-4 yet because it doesn't get updated that fast. But eco-anxiety is a recognized mental state that is, you know, that's causing kind of grave harm to youth.
It's causing suicides, yeah.
Because a lot of the climate rhetoric puts not only all the consequences, but all the responsibility on future generations. This is, you're going to have to solve this and you're going to suffer in the future in an indeterminate way.
It's really an existentialist fear. No other generation has ever had to deal with this and you don't know what it is either, but.
And in most cases, below a certain age, kids can't even fathom what you're talking. They're still learning that the rain brings the water back to the mountains and down to the crops and then out to the ocean. And you're telling them, no, that's all, you know,
that's all going to change.
Sorry,
probably.
Buddy. Like that's gone.
Boomers get that.
Did you see this poster of a polar bear? They're dead. And so in the current moment, right. And the fact that the doomsday clock is now trying to do what, you know, what it has always done, which is motivate men, to recognize the threat to their world by making them afraid. We're now in a state where alarmism is creating a great deal more denial, paralysis, and apathy than it is any kind of meaningful, like political action or recognizing like what our powers are in democratic society.
Yeah, in my experience, the young people are very aware that they cannot do the things that are being asked of them, and their result is
they're afraid, they angry, helpless,
surrender.
Guilty.
And it's
partly because fear, as you said very early in the show, it damages trust. Right? You see a world of only diminishing returns. Right? You don't feel like fear is not any kind of call to action. It's not. It doesn't offer any solutions. In 2018, Greta Thunberg tweeted, "A top climate scientist is warning that climate change will wipe out all of humanity unless we stop using fossil fuels over the next 5 years.
Well, that was 5 years ago, right?
It was 5 years ago. And in March of 2023, she deleted that tweet.
And that concludes the Doomsday Clock. Entry 372.1P0407, certificate number 26973. In the omnibus, futurelings, only you know when the clock actually ran out. Clock's a bad metaphor. It turns
out. It kind of is. What do you think is a better one?
It only works for nuclear arms. Like, what's something that gets just gradually a little bit worse every year? The internet?
And I think the Union of Concerned Scientists, or I'm sorry, the Atomic Bulletin scientists, are now including the threat of artificial intelligence in their calculations. And I guess as you add more threats, the clock ticks down.
I mean, really, you can't do that. You can't, you know, you've got to, if the number is going to be the same, you have to pretend, what would the number have been if AI had been baked in all along?
But yeah, I think
they need an equation. These boys need an equation.
Well, and this is the complaint, right? The complaint is that their methodology is opaque. They never explain how they arrive at these numbers. And it's not even really clear who is in the room, because they're not, you know, they don't publish like their results. They just move the thing on the clock.
They just have to move a thing. It's basically a bunch of people like standing there and moving an actual arm, and then they stand back a few steps and they're like, and somebody else takes a whack at it.
I think it should be measured in yards of beach out in front of like the Chelsea Hotel or whatever.
Because that's accurate.
Yeah. How many yards of beach are there in front of the Chelsea Hotel? Well, there's like a half a mile of beach and most of it's covered with paint. But, you know, eventually the seawaters are going to be at the door of the Chelsea Hotel. And we should be able to measure that.
It doesn't have AI in it. You need a second clock.
Oh, an AI clock. Well, AI doesn't care where the seas are. They don't care about the polar bears, right? They're going to be feeding us gruel and using our minds as, I don't know. I never understood the plot of those movies.
Well, chatbots of the future, assuming you are not mining organic matter for our metabolism, but have forgotten us. We were on a social media in our day, at Ken Jennings, at John Roderick, jointly at Omnibus Project. You could email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. Physical items could be sent to P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155. Here's something to you and me with a stamp of a cat on the outside. And this person got a thank you USPS. So, do you get better service? Is this like tipping?
No, it's like having a license plate surround that says, I support my local police retirement society, right?
You don't want to give me a ticket. Are you going to get one of those thin blue line stickers just to ward off traffic stops?
You know, it would be funny if you could have a thin blue line sticker that was behind a little trap door and you only flipped it down like, when you were getting pulled over.
Like James Bond flipping the license plate on his ass. This says Black Lives Matters when I'm parked some places. Now it says thin blue line.
That's right. No, I do not.
This is from MJ.
Michael Jackson?
That's right. He's back from the dead. Aloha from the highest point on Maui, the peak of, as you know, Haleakala.
Yeah, I've been there. You've been there.
I have. For interesting geography reasons, the top of the mountain looks like a desert and has many craters. Yes. MJ, you're not telling us. We don't
know. Yes. Also, the wind blows.
It's so windy and cold.
It's cold there. It's really cold.
It's also no fun for hiking because all you can do is kind of hike down into the crater. And as you go, you're gradually realizing, you know what? I'm going to have to hike out of this crater some point.
There's nothing to see down here.
Like, all I'm seeing is the same view, and I'm creating an uphill walk in a minute. But I do like this old-timey WPA
That's beautiful.
Art of Haleakala. Thank you for the postcard, MJ. If I'm getting this right, MJ also recently asked us if we would plug a nascent Omnibus Discord getting underway.
Okay.
So MJ is...
Tell us about it, MJ. Oh, you're not here.
But
tell us about it, Ken J.
There's no link, but... But keep your eye on the skies and possibly the Facebook page.
Futurelings, the Discord is out there and coming soon.
Ian sent us a postcard from Texas. Outdoor musical Palo Duro Canyon. Do they have outdoor musicals there, or is it just a very musical canyon? It's unclear.
Outdoor musical Polidoro Canyon.
He wrote, "Hi guys, longtime listener, first time sender of stuff." Then he was afraid it would smear, so he went over it again with green ink, and as a result, it looks like the Unabomber is. Thank you, Ian, for you're from Denver, but thanks for dropping us a postcard from Texas. And then, even more puzzling, Sharon from North Dakota, who I believe is Sharon the one who thinks we're continually
talking to her through her headphones. We are
slandering North Dakota.
Oh.
Isn't there someone who thinks we're unfair to North Dakota?
Well, I mean, South Dakota says that it's windy there because North Dakota blows and Nebraska sucks.
That's hilarious. We did that in Utah with Wyoming and Nevada.
Oh, you had the same joke.
I feel like maybe every state can do it except...
every windy state.
She sent us, puzzlingly, a hockey puck emblazoned with the logo, an official hockey puck. Emblazoned with the logo and a representation of Ralph Engelstad Arena in Grand Forks, the home of North Dakota hockey.
Wow.
I don't know who they play against because there's only one home.
They go up to Canada.
They go down to South Dakota to all the big cities. But on the back it says, consider yourself schooled.
Oh, we got schooled. Uh-oh, Sharon.
Was there at some point where we said there is certainly no arena that is the home of North Dakota hockey?
I can imagine us saying
that. And then 5 years later, we deleted that tweet because
hey, Ken,
Sharon sent us this puck.
How do you feel about North Dakota hockey?
I am sure there is not an arena that is its home.
I am
100% confident. Sharon, thank you for schooling us on this important point. We will accept your findings no matter what they were. Again, the Discord is coming, but there's already futurelings on Facebook. And it might have been the recent Reddit instability that led to the...
Reddit instability.
Because Reddit's now,
what? What was it ever?
It was losing money due to VC capital. They want to not lose money, and it turns out that makes the site no good for users. Huh,
interesting. Wanting to not lose money.
It turns out running for free was great. But so there is a Discord coming. There's also a Facebook and a subreddit. And the most important thing you can do to support Omnibus right now, if you think to yourself, you know what, I've listened to 100 hours of this and I've done nothing. I'm the Bureau of Unconcerned podcast listeners. You could take action. Don't be lulled into a sense of apathy or panic.
No, we don't want to be alarmist about this, but your contribution...
it could be the only thing.
That's right. It keeps Armageddon at bay. We're going to move the clock back from 90 seconds... to the Armageddon of Omnibus.
There is a Patreon number at which the show disappears, and we don't want to tell you what it is. We should have a clock that we're constantly moving.
Yeah.
Oh no, donations are down this month. Yeah, it's now 3 minutes to midnight.
3 minutes.
But consider, yours could be the inaction that dooms the entire enterprise.
We've never published that clock, but it does exist.
It's right here in the room. I'm looking at it right now. It's not looking great today, John, I gotta say. So if you have ever... I've been an Omnibus listener for whom the podcast means something, but you have never moved to support the show. Go ahead, move that minute hand back at patreon.com/omnibusproject.
Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We do know that this episode may be our longest episode ever.
Oh, is that true?
It's pretty long. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come and that we never go to an hour 30 again. Have we ever gone over an hour 30?
No, I don't think we've even been that close.
Well, we've been pretty close, but not as close as we are right now. We're only 30 seconds away.
Never closer, just like the doomsday clock.
If the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word. But if Providence allows, we wish you many goods and cheese and hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.